Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantagraph of Friday, February 14th, 2025. Happy Valentine's Day, and let us turn to page one, where the main story is about Livingston County, titled Path to Freedom in Local History. Historian and Pontiac exhibit tell of Underground Railroad role. This story is datelined Pontiac. Within its first decade of operation, the Underground Railroad was estimated to have helped about 100,000 enslaved people escape to freedom. According to the research of local author and historian Dale Malley, some of these freedom seekers may have passed through Livingston County on their journey north. On Tuesday, Malley gave presentations on the Underground Railroad's ties to Livingston County as one of the companion programs the Pontiac Public Library arranged to accompany its month-long display of the Journey to Freedom, Illinois' Underground Railroad exhibit. The exhibit, which will be on display through March 5th, aims to highlight the unsung heroes of the secret network of routes and safe houses run by free slaves, abolitionists, and other anti-slavery advocates. During his presentation, Malley said most of the major Underground Railroad routes passed through Ohio. Very few came through eastern Illinois. Most of them are on the west side of Illinois, which probably coincides with Mississippi River Railroads and the Illinois River, Malley said, and Missouri was a slave state down below. The first settlers of Livingston County arrived in 1830, but the county was not officially formed until 1837. At that time, the land was swampy and no railroads existed to ship agricultural supplies or other products, which would explain why there were no routes cutting through Livingston County when the Underground Railroad was established in 1840. But in 1850, Congress passed the Script Act, which gave veterans of past wars, primarily the War of 1812, free land. It created a land rush to settlers in Livingston County, and it took about 2 or 3 years for that act to kick in, Malley said. Communications weren't so fast back then, but if you look up the land records for Livingston County, almost everything was bought between 1853 and 1858. An 1878 Livingston County history book includes information about several abolitionists who participated in an Underground Railroad route that ran from Eppert's Point Township west of Fairbury to Pontiac and all the way to Ottawa, according to Malley. One of these abolitionists, William B. Fife, moved to Ottawa in 1849 and was a conductor and operated a depot or hiding place for enslaved people along the Underground Railroad. Fife later moved to Livingston County and set up a store in New Michigan. But because rail lines did not pass through the city, it eventually became a ghost town. Fife took to farming before joining a Pontiac-based law firm and enlisting in the Union Army. Malley also discussed Fairbury historian Alma Lewis James, who claimed in one of her books that another Underground Railroad route existed from Strawn to Odell with a stopover at a cabin on the Fugit farm northeast of Fairbury. This route was referenced in a photo from the Fairbury Blade newspaper, and James reported at least one enslaved person had been buried by the riverbank, but Malley said he could not find any supporting information for this route. Unfortunately, Alma never let the facts get in the way of telling a good story, he told a crowd gathered at the library on Tuesday. When Malley gave the same presentation in Fairbury, one attendee asked why enslaved people needed to travel all the way to Canada when free states still existed in the U.S. In September 1850, Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act, which required escaped slaves to be returned to their owners regardless of whether they were in a free state like Illinois. The responsibility for finding, returning, and trying escaped slaves fell on the federal government. However, this did not stop certain Livingston County citizens from protecting slaves on the run. Malley said an 1888 Livingston County history book recounted a story about Dr. C.B. Ostrander, one of the first doctors in the county and a staunch abolitionist. One day, Ostrander discovered a fugitive slave chained to the floor of a two-story building that was going to be returned to his master in Virginia. In response, Ostrander cut his shackles with a crowbar, hammer, and chisel and loaded him into a horse-drawn buggy. The man was delivered to Dr. C.V. Dyer, a prominent Chicago abolitionist. Ostrander gave him $10, which would be equal to $372 in 2025, and the fugitive was transported via steamship to freedom in Maiden, Canada. Although Harriet Tubman and John Rankin are among the most well-known conductors of the Underground Railroad, the Journey to Freedom exhibit provides an opportunity to highlight some of the abolitionists who helped guide enslaved people through Illinois. Among those featured in the exhibit, the Reverend John Cross came to Illinois in 1839 and was among the few who spoke openly about his work helping freedom seekers on the Underground Railroad. His work as a conductor eventually resulted in his arrest, but he later helped to establish Wheaton College near Chicago. In 1850, Henry Stevenson was sent by his enslaver from Missouri to help catch two escapees. He and a slave catcher named Uriah P. Hinch traveled across the state to Chicago. Little did his captors know, however, that Stevenson was plotting his own escape. Stevenson managed to find an African-American driver who took him to a local barbershop to make arrangements. After requesting money from Hinch to help bring down the fugitives, Stevenson hopped a train and a boat to make it into Canada. Henry Brown was born into slavery, separated from his family when he was sold at 12 and sold again at 14. Despite his early years, Brown grew up to become an ordained minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church at 23, and he married Mary Ann King at 25. The couple became conductors on the Underground Railroad in Paris, Springfield, Quincy, and the Galena area. Through this activism, Brown's family grew close to President Abraham Lincoln's family, and Brown was even asked to join Lincoln's funeral procession. To learn more about these and other influential figures, you can visit the exhibit at the Pontiac Public Library at 211 East Madison Street, or go to www.illinoisugrr.org. And our next front page story is about the U.S. government, titled "Kennedy Okayed as Health Secretary. Illinois Senators Join Dems Opposing Move." This is an Associated Press story, Dateline, Washington. The Senate on Thursday confirmed Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as President Donald Trump's health secretary, putting the prominent vaccine skeptic in control of $1.7 trillion in federal spending, vaccine recommendations, and food safety, as well as health insurance programs for roughly half the country. Nearly all Republicans fell in line behind Trump, despite hesitancy over Kennedy's views on vaccines, voting 52-48 to elevate the scion of one of America's most storied political and democratic families to Secretary of the Health and Human Services Department. Democrats, including both Illinois senators, unanimously opposed Kennedy. Both U.S. Senators Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth had voiced their opposition ahead of the vote. Duckworth, speaking on the Senate floor on Wednesday, said Kennedy's confirmation would endanger the future of Medicaid, a federal program that provides health care coverage for about 80 million of the poorest of Americans, including more than 3 million in Illinois. She also voiced concerns about the future of vaccination for diseases like measles, whooping cough, and polio. And she closed with an appeal to her Republican colleagues. "I am sure many of you have had a parent who's been sick or a nephew who's been in a car crash, a spouse who's needed an emergency C-section, or a child who's relied on an autoimmune injector, she said. Imagine if your loved one had not had care they could rely on in that moment. Then ask yourself how you can sleep soundly tonight if you vote to further the agenda of a couple rich guys who so clearly don't care about making America healthy. They only care about tipping it even more in favor of the wealthy. Durbin had called Kennedy totally unqualified not long after the nomination was announced in November. In a statement after Thursday's vote, he also described the new health secretary as unfit and dangerous. He has spewed harmful conspiracy theories about life-saving vaccines, lacks a basic grasp of our healthcare system, and approaches the job with an unacceptable bias, Durbin said. For the sake of our children and future generations who will suffer the most from his lies, I vehemently opposed his nomination. I wish my Republican colleagues would have done the same. Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell, who had polio as a child, was the only no vote among Republicans, mirroring his stance against Trump's pick for the Pentagon chief and director of national intelligence. I am a survivor of childhood polio. In my lifetime, I have watched vaccines save millions of lives from devastating diseases across America and around the world, McConnell said in a statement afterwards. I will not condone the relitigation of proven cures, and neither will millions of Americans who credit their survival and quality of life to scientific miracles. The rest of the GOP, however, has embraced Kennedy's vision with a directive for the public health agencies to focus on chronic diseases such as obesity. We have got to get into the business of making America healthy again, said Senator Mike Crapo, Republican of Idaho, adding that Kennedy will bring a fresh perspective to the office. Kennedy, 71, whose name and family tragedies have put him in the national spotlight since he was a child, has earned a formidable following with his populist and sometimes extreme views on food, chemicals, and vaccines. His audiences only grew during the COVID-19 pandemic when Kennedy devoted much of his time to a nonprofit that sued vaccine makers and harnessed social media campaigns to erode trust in vaccines as well as the government agencies that promote them. With Trump's backing, Kennedy insisted he was uniquely positioned to revive trust in those public health agencies, which include the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Institutes for Health. Last week, Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, said he hoped Kennedy goes wild in reining in health care costs and improving Americans' health. But before agreeing to support Kennedy, potential holdout Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, a doctor who leads the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, required as reassurances that Kennedy would not make changes to existing vaccine recommendations. During Senate hearings, Democrats tried to prod Kennedy to deny a long-discredited theory that vaccines cause autism. Some lawmakers also raised alarms about Kennedy financially benefiting from changing vaccine guidelines or weakening federal lawsuit protections against vaccine makers. Kennedy made more than $850,000 last year from an arrangement referring clients to a law firm that has sued the makers of Gardasil, a human papillomavirus vaccine that protects against cervical cancer. If confirmed as health secretary, he promised to reroute fees collected from the arrangement to his son. Kennedy will take over the agency in the midst of a massive federal government shakeup led by billionaire Elon Musk that has shut off, even if temporarily, billions of taxpayer dollars in public health funding and left thousands of federal workers unsure about their jobs. On Friday, the National Institutes of Health announced it would cap billions of dollars in medical research given to universities and cancer being used to develop treatments for diseases such as cancer and Alzheimer's. Kennedy, too, has called for a staffing overhaul at the NIH, FDA, and CDC. Last year, he promised to fire 600 employees at the NIH, the nation's largest funder of biomedical research. And our last front page story is the Cutting Board column titled Local Flower, a Sweet Surprise. Here at the Cutting Board, we have discussed a variety of different ingredients and products grown in and around McLean County, asparagus to zucchini, bratwurst and homemade ham, strawberries and pumpkins. But there is one ingredient that I have not been able to find within a stone's throw of the Twin Cities, no matter how many farmers and growers I asked. Wheat. This, of course, boggled my mind because wheats and grains are so essential to the rise of civilization and are key to America's history. It's even in the song, for golly's sake, Amber Waves of Grain. Imagine my surprise, then, when I was walking through the garlic press in Uptown Normal and found a bag of flour that said it was grown in Illinois, Ashcombe, to be exact. Well-traveled as I am, I had never heard of the 700-person village, which is closer to Indiana's border than far away Rantoul, but I was intrigued. So I reached out to the supplier, Janie's Mill. A few days later, the owners of the mill invited me to tour their certified organic operation at the intersections of Interstate 57 and U.S. Route 45. So, strap in, folks, because the Cutting Board is traveling to Iroquois County for some flour, and we're making cupcakes. On February 4th, I hopped in the car and went on an adventure to Ashcombe, arriving around 9 a.m. After spending several hours in their mill and talking to the owners and millers, learning about all their products and hearing their passion for growing food that is delicious, nutritious, and sustainable, I cannot recommend enough checking this place out for yourself. They regularly offer tours for which you can sign up on their website at janiesmill.com/pages/mill-tours. For this edition of the Cutting Board, we're going to discuss just a portion of Janie's Mills and the farm story. Throughout the year, as we look at other flours, grains, and products they produce, we will dive further into their history. Sitting inside their mill around a dining room table that looks like it's been in the family for generations, father and son owners Harold and Ross Wilkin shared their story. Harold Wilkin, the self-proclaimed cheerleader and promoter of the farm and mill, has been farming since the early 1980s and transitioned his farm to all organic in the early 2000s. "I hated GMOs," he said flatly. "I thought it's not right that you can spray a crop with a chemical and it not die. And I always felt like that chemical had to be absorbed by that plant. So where did that go?" "Into the food," he said. And as the ingredient lists on foods read more than a novella, more and more people are searching for products that have less additives and preservatives, said Ross Wilkin, day-to-day operator of the certified organic farm. "I feel like the ingredients list keeps getting longer every year on processed foods, and so I think people started to realize that we just want to cut back on that," he said. In no small part, based on health complications from ultra-processed foods, more families are rethinking their diets, Ross Wilkin said. "Sometimes things get bad for long enough that people start to wake up and then realize they need to reevaluate," he said. "So I feel like over the years, you know, we've gotten to a point where all of a sudden people start to be more mindful of it and realize that, oh man, you know, the Wonder Bread is not cutting it, like there's better options out there." "And it's also a generational shift," his father said. "My children want to feed their children better than we fed them," Harold Wilkin said. So in 2017, they built two stone mills and started milling their own wheat, wholesale at first for buyers in Chicago. And then in 2019, they revamped their web presence and started selling retail. Earlier this month, Janie's Mill celebrated its 100,000th retail sale. Now you can order any of 40-plus products from certified organic farms across the Midwest that are milled in Ashcombe to be delivered right to your door. Or you can find them at the Garlic Press and Green Top Grocery. In case you haven't heard, today is Valentine's Day, so I wanted to make some sweet treats to share with loved ones. Since I don't have a Valentine myself, I figured it would be fun to have a bake-off with my mother, Kelly, who has been cooking for longer than I've been around. She's also a much better baker than I am. First, a quick note on batters and doughs. Both are mixtures of flour and either milk or water, but a batter is considered a liquid, which is spooned or poured into a container, while a dough is not a liquid. Mom chose an apricot upside-down recipe from Viola Gorin's Two-Bite Cupcakes, something way too complex for me. I chose a basic strawberry cupcake recipe from Jennifer Shea's Cupcakes and Parties that I topped with homemade whipped cream. She used her trusty hand mixer, which I swear she's had for over 40 years, and made 2 dozen mini cupcakes with enough left over for a mega cupcake. Of course, Mom's cupcakes were amazing. Crunchy almond bits and maple apricot syrup made a really nice combo with way too much sugar for me. But something genuinely hilarious happened midway through her process. Instead of reaching for the all-purpose flour we got from Janie's Mill, she grabbed our tub of regular store-bought flour. I didn't notice it until she was folding in the crushed almonds and making the apricot syrup, so I pointed it out. "Oh, dang it," she exclaimed. "That was the whole point, wasn't it?" "It's okay, Mom. My recipe didn't call for creme fraiche, so I think I deserve the special flour. I used both the AP flour and some cake flour in my batch, and the crumb of this cake was delicious, with the occasional strawberry piece a nice tart surprise. I'm not very good at baking, though, so I guess it's all right that I don't have a Valentine to share these with. I'll just leave them in the office break room." And we turn now to some local and state news. This story is headlined, "Normal Gets High Marks in Most Areas of Quality of Life Survey." This story is datelined Normal. Normal residents gave top marks to quality of life and overall satisfaction in the town's community survey. The survey, developed in partnership with Zen City, provided residents the opportunity to express views on aspects of life, including housing, education, transportation, waste and recycling services, and public safety. The survey ran from November 2024 through January 2025 and netted 502 respondents. Town staff shared the results of the survey Thursday, noting 7 out of 10 residents, or approximately 72% survey respondents, indicated the quality of life is good or excellent, which is 8% higher than similar communities in the region and 9% higher than the national average. Also, 61% of residents would recommend Normal as a place to live. "This is the town's second survey round, and we are again gratified with the results," said Normal City Manager Pam Reese in a prepared statement. "Our scores are steady, fluctuating plus or minus a point or two. More importantly, they consistently meet or exceed national averages. That is the goal. We will keep asking the community to tell us how we're doing, and we will watch our scores over time, digging in to see how we can improve." In addition to high marks for quality of life, respondents indicated positive satisfaction in the following areas. 72% are satisfied with quality of parks and recreational amenities. 71% satisfied with quality of waste and recycling services. 70% satisfied with access to quality education. 70% satisfied with overall quality of services provided by the town. And 57% satisfied with availability of a variety of art and cultural events. As for the sense of overall safety, 64% of residents rate this positively, while 24% gave it a neutral ranking, and 13% had low satisfaction. These scores match regional cohort scores and exceed the national average of 60%. When asked to consider this provided statement, the town operates in a way that exhibits transparency and accountability. Respondent scores improved from 42% in late summer 2024 to 50% in January 2025. During the time the survey ran, staff provided the community with a lot of information about community financial trends, the budgeting process, and the town's five-year community investment plan, Reese said. The lowest satisfaction scores were 22% for availability of affordable housing and 36% for availability of jobs that pay a living wage. And the full survey result report is available at normalill.gov/Jan2025results. And Crow and Troubadour set for State Fair. This story is Dateline Springfield. The Illinois State Fair has announced two additional performers for the grandstand lineup this summer. Headlining on Tuesday, August 12th, will be nine-time Grammy winner Sheryl Crow. And on Sunday, August 17th, the Turnpike Troubadours, hailing from Tahlequah, Oklahoma, and dubbed the Kings of Red Dirt Music, will take the grandstand stage. Crow's first nine albums have sold over 35 million copies worldwide. Seven albums have charted in the top 10, and five have been certified multi-platinum, according to a news release. Crow previously played the Illinois State Fair grandstand nearly 30 years ago. She is best known for hits like The First Cut is the Deepest, If It Makes You Happy, Soak Up the Sun, All I Want to Do, Steve McQueen, There Goes the Neighborhood, Every Day is a Winding Road, and more. The Turnpike Troubadours have earned over 1.5 billion streams globally and have sold out various arenas and festivals. They have released five albums across different genres. The group took a break in 2019 but returned to release their sixth studio album, A Cat in the Rain, in 2023. Popular songs include Long Hot Summer Day, Good Lori Lori, Pay No Rent, 7 and 7, Gin Smoke Lies, Mean Old Son, and more. Tickets for both shows will go on sale at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 15th via Ticketmaster. Tickets for Crow's show range from $40 to $105. Turnpike Troubadour tickets range from $55 to $125. And $30 pre-show party tickets are available for each concert. The 2025 Illinois State Fair is set for August 7th through 17th in Springfield. Other grandstand acts so far are Def Leppard on August 16th and Megan Maroney on August 10th, and other headliners are still to be announced. And here is today's Flick Fact question. If you are dining out in Bloomington Normal tonight, what is different from any other night of the year? And the answer is more tables for two, lots more. Valentine's Day is the one time, the only time, when restaurants like Biagi's find couples tables in higher demand than four tops or larger. Every other night, it's usually the opposite. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, February 14th, 2025. I look forward to reading part two with you next.